I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, a conversation about one of the Supreme Court's most notorious and consequential decisions. In 1896, Plessy v. Ferguson allowed equal but separate accommodations for blacks and whites, legalizing segregation for more than 60 years. In his new book, Steve Luxenberg tells the backstory of some of the people who were central to this historic case, tracing the pernicious roots of racism in American history and reminding us that despite clear progress in civil rights, we are to this day struggling with the same kind of bigotry that informed the policies of our founders and those who governed in the years following Reconstruction. The book is called Separate, the story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's journey from slavery to segregation. Steve Luxenberg joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, a conversation about one of the most consequential and notorious cases ever decided by the Supreme Court, Plessy v. Ferguson. In 1892, Homer Plessy, a young shoemaker with some African ancestry who often passed for white, boarded a train in New Orleans and was arrested when he sat in the whites-only railway car. His arrest formed the basis of a Supreme Court challenge to the Louisiana Separate Car Act, a state law that allowed blacks and whites to be segregated while riding the train. The court's decision 4 years later enshrined in American law the concept that if blacks and whites had access to equal accommodations, those accommodations could remain separate. It wasn't until 60 years later in the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education case that the doctrine of separate but equal was repudiated by the court. My guest today is Steve Luxenberg, an associate editor at the Washington Post, whose latest book chronicles the events that led up to the landmark ruling by tracing the lives of four key players in the drama: a white abolitionist from New York, a black newspaper editor from New Orleans, and the justices that wrote both the majority and dissenting opinions. Spanning the decades that preceded the ruling, Luxenberg masterfully explicates the segregationist doctrine that was not only a matter of practice, but was the law of the land from the late 19th century until the advent of the modern civil rights era. The book is called Separate, the story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's journey from slavery to segregation. Steve Luxenberg joins me in Studio A. We'll take your calls in a little bit. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. And you can also check us out on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
This book is terrific. I just really, really was fascinated by the whole story and the way you structured it. I just think it's a real achievement. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. I hope the rest of the hour is as good as that.
Yes, we're off to a good start. You're off to a good start. The first thing is like a minor factoid. The actual term of art in the decision is equal but separate. And it has come to be known as the doctrine of separate but equal. Why is that and does it matter?
I think it doesn't really matter, but the term equal but separate was more common in those days because the law in Louisiana that you referenced, that was the term in the preamble to the law. You must have equal but separate accommodations. There's a reason for that. In the progressive nature of that era in the 1880s, they were accepting separation, but they were saying, but it must be equal. Must be equal. It doesn't become separate but equal until the Supreme Court in 1954 in the Brown decision uses that term. And that's how we see it today. Plessy wasn't regarded as a major case when it came out. And the words separate but equal, amazingly enough, do not appear in the majority decision.
Interesting that the whole notion of separate but equal is premised in an assumption that as long as it's equal, it's not racism. It's not bigotry. And that is something that the founders struggled with, when they dealt with slavery and the Constitution. They're dealing with it, obviously, in the Civil War. They're dealing with it in Reconstruction. They're dealing with it at the time of Plessy, and we're still dealing with it today.
Well, race is a part of our national conversation, and as you suggested, it was from the very beginning when the people who wrote the Constitution in 1789 embedded slavery in it. The word slavery doesn't appear, but they embedded slavery by referring to 3/5 of a person to refer to those enslaved people in the South, allowing the South to have greater political representation in apportionment. That was a compromise. For the next half century, that holds on. But a revolution occurs in the Constitution in the years after the Civil War, when three really important amendments are passed, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. The first abolishes slavery. The second establishes equal protection under the laws and gives citizenships to black, explicitly gives citizenships to black. And the third gives voting rights to black men. Black men, not black women, not white women, black men. That's a revolution. If you think of those two constitutions, they are entirely different documents as it revolves around that incredibly important point.
When you think, when people who don't study this the way you do or other historians do, when they're not legal scholars, you think about the big Supreme Court cases that are sort of etched in the public imagination. One of them is Dred Scott, probably, Dred Scott versus Stanford. That's 1857. Plessy, which is 1896. And then Brown v. Board of Education, which sort of repudiates the separate but equal doctrine.
It does
repudiate the doctrine in 1954. Maybe Roe v. Wade is another one now, which has nothing to do with discrimination. But as you mentioned, Plessy at the time wasn't considered a major case. It was only considered sort of a really important sort of landmark thing until much, much later. Why do you think that is?
Well, you have to see the Supreme Court in the context in which it really exists. No case, no moment by itself is perceived at the moment to be as much of a landmark. Brown is an exception because Brown was a repudiation and it was stated clearly. But most of the time, Supreme Court cases are an accretion. A case comes first, another case follows. Those two cases are used as a precedent for a third. And Plessy was the third of three important civil rights cases. The first was in 1883, repudiating the Civil Rights Act of 1875. I like to remind people that when we talk about the civil rights movement, we always think of the 1960s. We never think of the civil rights movement of the 1860s. And there was one mm-hmm. that led to the Civil Rights Acts of 66, 1870, 1875. The Supreme Court was narrowing its definition of the 14th Amendment, which was a new amendment. And so it had three civil rights cases, 83, 1889, 90, and then 1896. The Plessy case was expected, much the way that today there are certain cases when they come before the court. They may get a lot of attention because there's a lot of media, but there's an expected ruling because the court has already said in previous cases what it would do. So if the Supreme Court in 1896 had ruled the other way, it would have been a thunderbolt. And there was no thunderbolt coming.
Yeah. I mean, you've talked about it in a couple of points, but just in a broad way, what is it that we don't know about Plessy? I mean, obviously, there have been a whole bunch of other books articles and research done about this case. You're not a lawyer. You're not a legal historian. You're an editor, investigative reporting editor for the Washington Post. What drew you to it, and what do you think it is that we didn't know that we really need to know? And you
supply well, you know, in my 40 years of journalism, amazing to me that I have to say that, 40 years.
You started when you were 12.
I started at the Baltimore Sun. I live in Baltimore. And throughout those 40 years, like a lot of journalists, I return again and again to conversations and stories that involve race. I edited a Pulitzer Prize-winning series in 1994 that was largely about a black family in Washington and its generational problems with poverty and with drug abuse. I keep thinking about race, which, as I said, is part of the national conversation. And so as I looked for a topic for another book, I thought there is no more important subject than the subject of race. And I wanted to understand this case that is so infamous. But if you ask people what was the Plessy case about, they will immediately say separate but equal if they don't say Dred Scott. Often they confuse the two. But that's all they're really able to say. They don't know who Plessy was. They don't even know his first name. They don't know what he was arrested for, that he was arrested on a railroad car. They don't know the composition of the court, how many of the justices, the nine justices, how many of them decided the case, and how many of them from the North, and how many from the South. So these basic facts, which we'll get to in a minute, I wanted to understand. And then as I began to dig into it, I was cursed as a young reporter, an editor told me, because he said, Steve, you always want to get near the bottom of things. And, you know, sometimes in daily journalism, you can't get near the bottom of things. Well, in a book, you have a better shot at getting near the bottom of things. And I discovered that racial separation as a concept, as an idea, I'm not the first to discover this, goes back to the 1830s in Massachusetts in the North. And I decided you can't tell this story by just staying in the courtrooms of Louisiana and Washington in the 1890s, that doesn't add anything new to the case. And as you said, I'm not a legal scholar, but I am a storyteller. Several reviews have called me a storyteller. I embrace that definition. That's what I am.
Well, spoiler alert, his name was Homer Plessy. He was 29 years old. Tell us a little bit about him and also the fact that this was not the first test case to challenge this law that required blacks and whites to sit in separate cars on the railroad.
Well, using my storyteller idea, let me set a scene for you. We're talking about New Orleans. This case comes out of the mixed race, French-speaking Creole community in New Orleans. And in the book, I say that it could not have come out of any other city, I don't think, in the United States at that time. New Orleans was unlike Atlanta or Charleston or Savannah because it had a wealthier, educated group of mixed-race people who had been free, or their ancestors had been free, for more than a century. Plessy was born in 1863. He was not born into slavery. His parents weren't in slavery. His grandparents weren't in slavery. You have to go back to his great-grandmother on one side to 1779 when she was freed to find somebody who had been enslaved. So this is a group that when the Americans take over in 1803, there's 6,000 free people of color in New Orleans. They are expecting to get rights because they're promised in the treaty. They're also expecting it in 1860s when the federal troops arrive and liberate the city from the South. They're expecting it in the aftermath of the Civil War. And by 1890, to use a modern term, they're kind of an unhappy, pissed off group of people.
Yeah.
And they see the Separate Car Act come into existence in 1890, mandating. Now, there had been a practice of separation, as I said, in the 1830s in Massachusetts, but that was the custom of a railroad. This is a law mandated by the legislature, and they're not going to sit still for it. And so, like the people who had come before, many people had been resisting separation during the half century that came before. They stood on the shoulders of those people. And they said, we're going to bring a test case. And so Homer Plessy is a volunteer. He wants to get arrested. He wants to end up in jail so that they can manipulate the case legally to get to the Supreme Court, which is not easy, but they do it.
You mentioned that there's a difference between a railroad policy and a law, right? So Plessy was actually the second attempt to address this law. The first attempt didn't work because it was a train that didn't just stay in the state of Louisiana. It was an interstate train. So there were federal guidelines or federal statutes that didn't need to be challenged, I guess. Right?
Well, it's fascinating how such a small little thing can affect a case. They didn't think about this when they asked Daniel Dadoon. That was the first volunteer, another mixed-race person. Both of them they were fair-skinned and looked more white than black, and that was intentional. When they put him on the train, they didn't think about where the train was going. He bought a ticket to Mobile, Alabama, and later on, the Louisiana Supreme Court, in a separate case, in an unrelated case, ruled that the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution meant that this Louisiana statute was invalid as it applied to trains running outside the state. And they looked at the ruling and they cheered. They celebrated. They wrote newspaper articles about it in the Crusader. That was Louis Martinet's newspaper. He was the head of the committee. And then they said, oh my God, it's still okay to have separation on trains only running in the state. We got to do this all over again. And so Homer Plessy was the second.
And people really couldn't. They were not in a position to challenge the particular policy of a particular railroad. I mean, the company made the rules and that was that. You either agreed with them or you didn't. But they could challenge, as you said, this state law. And interestingly, the railroad companies were on the side of the plaintiffs in the case. They sided with Plessy. They were not at all thrilled by the requirement to have separate accommodations. And this, we hear about this all the way going up through the 1950s and 1960s, where separate bathrooms, separate water coolers, separate everything. Business owners in the South, by and large, opposed that because it was just more expensive.
Yeah, the economics of it are really interesting because there weren't as many black passengers or mixed race passengers. So you could have a car that is overcrowded with whites, and you could have a half empty car with black passengers. They solved, quote unquote, this problem by partitioning the car and saying that, sort of like Rosa Parks to the back of the bus, this half of the car is for people of color, this half of the car is for whites, if they needed more people. But they were in on it in Louisiana. In Georgia, the Georgia Railroad was as racist as the policy. They really did not want to have their passengers mixing, and they were more than happy to have separate cars. They thought it was a good business expense because they thought their white passengers would be happier. But let me say one thing about what you said. You couldn't challenge a company policy. In fact, many people challenged these company policies in the 1830s and 40s and 50s, 1860s. They challenged them by bringing assault cases against the conductors, saying that you assaulted me when you ejected me from the train. Mm-hmm. Or the other car wasn't equal. You put me in that other car. I'm challenging it because it wasn't equal. The upholstery was dirty. People were smoking in that car. It smelled, you know, whatever the reason was. Sometimes they were successful, usually at the lower courts. Most of the time, when they got to the last stop on their appeal, they were unsuccessful. But when you look at the Plessy case, if you read it and you look at the precedents that are cited, nearly all of them come from cases that originated in the North, not in the South.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Bigotry was by no means limited to the South. We're going to take a little break. Steve Luxenberg is my guest. The book is Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. It is terrific. I can't recommend it highly enough. We can accept your phone calls and emails and tweets when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. You can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming live from Studio A. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Racism and Redemption, the controversy surrounding the revelations that top officials in Virginia wore blackface more than 30 years ago has occasioned a conversation about how that kind of behavior can and should be understood. Does a medical school yearbook picture depicting a white man in blackface standing next to a person garbed in the hood of the Ku Klux Klan indicate merely a youthful indiscretion? Or is this one a no-brainer? Simply clearly points to inherent racism. The columnist E.R. Shipp joins me, along with Lawrence Ross. He's written about racism on college campuses. We'll talk about racism and redemption tomorrow. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Everything is Wonderful at the Everyman Theater in Baltimore. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you just joined us today, my guest is Steve Luxenberg. We're talking about his new book called Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. To join us on the phone, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To drop us a tweet, @MiddayWIPR. You can also ping us on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Steve, let's talk about some of the characters that you profile in depth. The first is a guy who, by the time Plessy comes around, is a very well-known columnist, journalist. His name is Albion Tourget, a fascinating character. And you talk about his centrality to this case. This case would not have gone forward without his involvement.
Well, he was a northerner. He was born in Ohio on the Western Reserve. Now, that name doesn't mean anything to us today, but the Western Reserve was that part of Ohio up in the northeast corner that was reserved to Connecticut before the country was founded. And it was the most politically radical part of Ohio. His family had been there for a while. They had come from Massachusetts, And he is not the most politically attuned guy when the Civil War rolls around. He says his wife-to-be, and his wife is a very important part of his story, his wife-to-be is a more radical Republican than he is, the Republicans in those days being the party of anti-slavery. And he serves in the Civil War. He goes to the South. He interacts with people of color. He becomes radicalized. And he says, in paraphrasing Lincoln, "I don't want a union as it was. I want a union better than it was." And the way to do that, he thought, was to go down to the South, to be a carpetbagger, a term of scorn from Southerners, but one that he wore like a badge of honor. And he went to North Carolina to make the union better than it was by cementing the revolution, the abolition of slavery. He stays for 15 years in North Carolina, and then he's basically run out of the state. When he leaves, one of the newspapers says he's the most hated man in North Carolina, and in white supremacist circles, that would have been true. He goes back to the North, he becomes a newspaper columnist, and by 1890, he is the most famous white advocate for civil rights in America, yet his name is relatively unknown today, although there are some excellent biographies, which of course I read, about him.
And you've even said that at the time, he was virtually as famous as someone like Frederick Douglass, for example.
He was in that conversation. I mean, if he were alive today, you would see him as a public intellectual. He had written some best-selling novels about Reconstruction. They were compared, if you can believe this, to Uncle Tom's Cabin. That's how popular they were, how well-regarded they were. And because of his notoriety, the committee in New Orleans, the one that brings the Plessy case, they write to him for, quote, advice. Well, advice turns into an offer to join the legal team, and he becomes the leading strategist. And he sees this case as a possibility to continue to make his mark. Now, in the 19th century, unlike today, people who thought they were bright and smart, they didn't worry about being seen as overly ambitious. They wore their ambition proudly. I'm going to make my mark in the world. And Albion Turgay wanted to make his mark through the Plessy case.
And you also remind us what a huge risk this case was. Because here's this law. They bring it up before the Supreme Court. And if they lose, which, of course, they did, that law is then completely enshrined across the country. So this was not done lightly. I mean, they knew what they were up against, and they knew. You ever play the card game Hearts?
Yes.
You know, so in Hearts, there's a thing called shooting the moon, right? And if you try to shoot the moon and you win, and you're successful, you win the game. But if you shoot the moon and fail, you're done. And that's what happened here. They shot the moon, and it didn't work out.
And, you know, lawyers in the listening audience will know that it's a danger to ever bring a case that you can't win, because then you end up having a result that you can't live with. Turgay recognized this. He actually wrote it in a letter to Louis Martinet, the head of the committee, and said it would be better not to bring this case at all than to lose it. So you might wonder, if that's 1893 and the ruling is in 1896, why did they go ahead? Well, they thought about not going ahead. In fact, they delayed. They delayed various steps because they wanted to get a better Supreme Court. Does that sound familiar? It wasn't going to happen. They weren't going to get a better Supreme Court. But, you know, I say in the book, and this is kind of my best educated guess, they were fighters. They knew that if they didn't bring this case, somebody else would bring this case, and they were not going to go back to the sidelines, because Martinet had gone to a convention in 1882, where Frederick Douglass was the main keynote speaker. And Douglass said, "You have to always fight. You can't stay on the sidelines." And Martinet thought he was doing what Douglass wanted him to.
And, of course, Douglass himself advised against it.
Yeah, we don't know much about this because Douglass's letter doesn't survive. But Martinet's letters about what Douglass said to him survive. And what Martinet told Turgay was, "Frederick Douglass doesn't want us to bring this case. He won't give us his support." And he was furious at Douglass. I wish I knew more about what Douglass's thinking was, but I suspect that his thinking was, one, it was a losing case, and two, he wasn't so happy about a mixed-race French-speaking Creole group bringing this case. That was not Douglass's constituency.
And the final vote was 7-1. To one. The one dissent is this man named Justice Harlan, John Harlan, and as a 25-year-old, he had run for Congress on a pro-slavery platform in Kentucky. So he's the Southerner that writes this now very famous dissent in the majority opinion, and six of the seven people voting against Mr. Justice Harlan are Northerners. And was that the reason Tourjet and Martinet thought that maybe they'd have a shot because we have the court was stocked with Northerners?
I think that was not their initial thinking. I think that became their thinking later on. And Tourjet actually makes a tally at one point. Who's going to be with us and who's going to be against us? And he doesn't name everybody, but he kind of puts them into categories. Possible, maybe, and hopeless. Harlan is the only one he says is certainly for us. And he is, of course, right about that, because Harlan has shown that he is evolution from that pro-slavery candidacy that you'd spoke of had already been complete. He had renounced his slavery views. He had run for governor in Kentucky in 1871, and the campaign was all about why he had renounced those views. Mr. Harlan, why aren't you still in favor of the white supremacy? And Harlan said, quoting his mentor, Henry Clay, "I'd rather be right than consistent." So he was a flip-flopper, proudly.
Proud flip-flopper. Steve Luxenberg is the author of Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So what is it about Harlan then that by the time he's appointed to the court and this case comes before it, he is so vehement in his opposition to this law? What accounts for his evolution from a bigot to a person who is more open-minded?
So think of Harlan in those days as a politician and not as a judge. It's Kentucky. Kentucky is a border state in the Civil War. He goes from his pro-slavery candidacy to raising a Union regiment to preserve the Union, but writes in an open letter to the Louisville paper published that if it becomes a war to get rid of slavery, I'm out. He gets out because of his father's death, not because of that. But in 1864, just to show you that he meant it, he stumps for the Democratic candidate, George McClellan, against Lincoln, and criticizes Lincoln for making it a war to abolish slavery. After the war, he becomes Kentucky's Attorney General. He opposes the three amendments that we talked about that abolish slavery and enshrine equal protection under the law into the Constitution. But by 1868, he has no political home. He's lost. There is no place for a Harlan in the world. And he has ambition. He wants to be somebody. And so he looks at the Democrats and says, well, they're all ex-Confederates, and I fought against them. So the only place I can go is the Republican Party. And so he joins the Republican Party, and he meets a man named Benjamin Bristow, becomes his law partner. And Bristow is much more progressive and radical than Harlan, and Bristow ends up, I think, having a tremendous influence on Harlan. And by 1877, when President Hayes nominates him to the court, Harlan has made this conversion and has to defend himself at the Senate Judiciary Committee, not at a hearing, in writing. I'm a good Republican, he says. I'm a loyal Republican. I may have come late to the party, but I'm here. Don't reject me.
And the justice who wrote the majority opinion, Justice Henry Billings Brown, speaking of politicians and speaking of ambition, this man's ambition was certainly naked.
Well, Brown is a fascinating character. I was drawn to the story in part because of these contradictory characters. Brown, the New England-born man, ends up in Michigan as a young man where he becomes a lawyer. He ends up writing this terrible, infamous decision. And yet he grew up in communities where he came in contact with people who were fervently anti-slavery, and he's mentored by people who are anti-slavery. How does he end up writing this terrible decision? And then Harlan, the man who came from a slaveholding family, who inherited his father's slaves, he ends up writing the dissent. How does he end up in that position? So I just thought, as a storyteller, that's the story of America. Two men on different paths colliding at this critical moment in 1896. They were friends, but they weren't on the same side in this case.
And you mentioned Martinet, who around the time of this decision and this plan to bring this case in front of the court had been studying medicine. I mean, he'd been doing all these other things, but he's the editor of this very important publication in New Orleans. And you mentioned this Creole community of mixed race folks. Tell us about that newspaper and the role that it played in that society.
Well, in the 19th century, one of the ways to establish yourself as a presence was through newspapering. And the newspapers in those days are nothing like the newspapers that are around today. And, of course, newspapering is changing now. They were very political. It's no accident that there are newspapers existing now that are called the Springfield Republican or the Arkansas Democrat, because that shows their lineage. They were the organs of political parties. And they were naked about it. There was no objectivity. By the 1880s and 90s, that's changing. Reporting, that is, actual facts, are becoming part of the newspapering. Martinet was always editing a newspaper. He had edited two previously to the Crusader, the one that you're talking about, in 1890. And that was their way of, it was a companion to their advocacy. And that was how he saw it.
And he's the one that arranged for first Dedun and then secondly Homer Plessy to be the people. He was crucial to that decision. I mean, he helped pick the clients.
He was, although he was not the only one. I mean, Turgot said to him, "Find me a man who looks almost white, because I want to argue that in mixed race Louisiana, a conductor walking down the aisles can't just look at people and say, 'Well, you're black, you're white.'" Come to Plessy and you say, "Well, what are you?" And I actually have a line in the book when I say, one newspaper has him ask, "Are you a colored man?" And the other newspaper has the conductor asking, "Are you a white man?" And I don't know which conversation took place, but I thought it was funny enough that I said, both? Neither? It's New Orleans. It's not a contradiction, because people are of mixed race.
Because you describe him as something of like 1/8 African ancestry, you know? So he's mostly white in that sense.
He's closer to white than black.
He's closer to white than black.
You know, Turgot argued in his brief that he was 1/8. And the documents, the letters show that he doesn't really know what he is. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a fan of using percentages to describe somebody's ethnic or racial background. But I did the genealogy, and I can tell you that Plessy was 1/4 black, 3/4 white. And therefore, it was closer to white than he was to black. And Turgot makes an argument about that. He says, amazingly enough, that your race is your property. And if you can pass for white, then you cannot be deprived of the value of that property without due process.
Yeah, he uses the phrase, the reputation of being white.
The reputation of being. And the reason he says that
And he uses the term forcible confiscation of the reputation,
right,
of your white propertiness. Yeah.
And the reason he does that is because he makes the argument, if you could choose to be white or black in America in 1890, which would you choose? Which has the greater privileges? He goes through it. He has a litany. Which has greater wealth? Which has greater property, etc.? It's not a very good argument, though, if your constituency is black. Because, as I say in the book, let's say they had won. Would you have a car with white and mixed race passengers and then a separate car for black passengers? You could have had that. That would be terrible.
Steve Luxenburg, the book is called Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. He's going to be speaking about it tonight with Judge Robert Bell. Judge Bell is the first African-American to serve as the chief judge of the Maryland Court of Appeals. That event is at the Church of the Redeemer in North Baltimore. It's part of the Open Society Institute's Talking About Race series. We will talk more about this terrific book when we come back from a break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. And you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming our conversation. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for Midday today. If you've just joined us, my guest is Steve Luxenburg. He's the author of the new book, Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. The book was released just yesterday, and even before it was published, it won an award, the J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award. That's pretty slick, Steve. I mean, you get an award before you even publish the book. That's a new one. I joked
with my wife that I can now retire and not write the book.
Yeah, right. The award's done. Why finish?
It's a terrific award because Lucas was a New York Times journalist turned author, and his work is about nonfiction narrative. So I felt that I needed to write a book that he might like.
Yeah.
If he were still with us.
Yeah, that's great. Steve is a longtime senior editor at the Washington Post who has overseen reporting that has been honored with, among other awards, 2 Pulitzer Prizes. You are welcome to join our conversation about this new book, Plessy, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to drop us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So you make the case that the people who voted in the majority and Justice Brown, who wrote the majority opinion, it's too almost kind of facile to dismiss them as, you know, racist men of their times. That was just the way that zeitgeist was, and that's all there is to it. That's the simple explanation for their view of this. What's the deeper explanation?
Well, it would be wrong to suggest that they weren't racist, or at least some of them. Some of them believe that whites were superior to blacks. And even Harlan said in his dissent that he assumes that the white race will be the superior race for some time to come, but that was no excuse for treating them unequally, that the Constitution is colorblind. He has been made famous for this statement. He wasn't the first to use it. He picked it up from Turgot's brief. Turgot lives on through that phrase. You know, the explanation in part is that they didn't accept the 14th Amendment yet the way we see it today. The 14th Amendment today, equal protection under the law and no abridgment of rights without due process, means that it sort of unifies the country, that laws will be the same everywhere. But they picked on the clause in the amendment that said that states have no right to abridge the rights of people on the basis of color or race, and said, well, this is not a state law often. Now, it was a state law in Louisiana, so how did they contort themselves to come to this decision? Well, they said, it's true it's a state law, but under Louisiana's police powers, that's a term of art in the law, they have the license to enact legislation that preserves law and order.
Yeah, it's a keep the peace argument.
Keep the peace argument. And they just threw out the 14th and 13th Amendment arguments that Turgot made. Turgot didn't really get, you know, the game for a lawyer is you've got to bring arguments that are new. Because, as I said, the court had already ruled on this, and so they hunted for how to phrase their arguments so that the court couldn't say, well, we've already decided this. He's been criticized, Turgot, for not arguing harder that the cars were unequal. But that really wasn't their goal. They wanted to kill separation.
But the cars were definitely unequal, though.
Well, I don't know much about the cars on the East Louisiana Railroad, but the cars throughout the South and in the North, too, were unequal. The railroads would often argue, they're the same manufacturer, the same upholstery, the same this, the same that. Yes, but the car for people of color wasn't maintained. It was a smoking car. It was smelly. It hadn't been cleaned properly. No one wanted to sit there. The ventilation was no good, et cetera.
Yeah. And it's interesting, at the core of this, the Civil War just hovers over this whole story. By the time of the decision, it's only 3 decades hence from the Civil War. So there are a lot of people who were involved in the war, like Turgot, et cetera, and Harlan, who were, you know, active and part of the public discourse. And slavery was, when we talk about separating blacks and whites on a railroad car, you make a really interesting point that the whole notion of slavery and required very close contact between black people and white people, the slavers and the enslaved. I mean, there was nothing separate about the relationship between black and white people on a plantation.
And that's why separation's birth is in the North, where there aren't very many free blacks, because not a big population. In Massachusetts, where the first railroad car that's separate is in Massachusetts in 1838, there's only 1% of the population are people of color. But it raises the question, where do I sit? The dawn of the railroad age makes you ask that question, because stagecoaches aren't big enough to have a large population of people riding. But a railroad car comes in, and immediately you're thrown into a mass of humanity. And so that's where separation is born, in Salem, Massachusetts, on the Boston to Salem run on the Eastern Railroad in 1838.
Yeah, in the North.
In the North.
Not here. Yeah, not in New Orleans, in the South. And why the primacy of New Orleans as a player in this story is also very interesting, because New Orleans, of course, is in the South, but it was really a kind of a sui generis place compared to an Atlanta or a Memphis or a Lexington, Kentucky.
Well, New Orleans is, as I said earlier, is a place that has a history before the Americans take it over. And when the provisional governor arrives, he has never seen anything quite like this group of free people of color. They are the predecessors to Plessy, not just the predecessors in agitation, literally the predecessors. His grandparents and his parents are involved in some of them are involved in this struggle. One of them signs a petition, 1,000 people sign this petition, asking President Lincoln for their rights. And his grandfather is one of those people.
Tourget is this white advocate and activist for racial equality. What kind of movement? I mean, there were abolitionists that we know of, the Quakers and whatnot, but I mean, how big was this movement? How big was the Tourget camp when it came to race relations at that time?
Well, as I said, his wife is very important to his life, and she was furious at him for starting an equal rights association, because the number of subscribers began pouring in to their little town of Mayville in upstate New York. And she is so overwhelmed with having to manage the subscription list that they have to hire somebody. They don't have the money to hire somebody. And all you're asked to give to be a member of this association is $10. But Tourget thinks he's building a movement. And in this period of time, we have to remember, there were conferences in which the question was asked, what about the Negro question? Can you imagine classifying a whole people as a problem that needs to be discussed? And Tourget refused to use that phrase in a speech that he gave at one of these conferences. He made a point of it.
And Frederick Douglass also hovers around this story, because Frederick Douglass was, you know, one of the most famous people really in the world at this time. And he's working for equal rights, and you write that it's a goal to be attained, not an achievement to be celebrated. What does that mean, and how does Douglass play? I mean, we talked earlier about how he was opposed to the strategy of putting the Plessy case before the Supreme Court. But how did he inform this whole story?
Well, Douglass is in the book from the very beginning to the end. Not very much, but he's there frequently. And that's because he's one of the passengers that gets thrown off the railroad cars in Massachusetts, and he grips the seat so hard that he rips it off of its bolts, he says in his memoir later on. Well, after the Civil War and during the period of the 1880s, he was frequently at major political events. And he spoke to the 1876 political convention, the Republican political convention, and he said, you know, you white people keep celebrating yourselves for having enacted all of these equal rights things, but I don't think we're done here, and I don't think we're making a lot of progress. And so that's what he meant when he said, don't celebrate it, let's keep going. And the radical Republicans who had passed these laws and these amendments, the ratification going to the states of those three amendments, they knew they weren't done. That's why if you go back and look at the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, look at the 14th and 15th, the last section. It says, and Congress shall have the authority or the power to enact legislation to enforce this amendment. Now, why would you think that would be necessary? because they knew that they needed to enact legislation to give it some enforcement power. So that's a very important part of those two amendments.
Of course, Douglas doesn't live even to see the decision. I mean, he dies a year before the decision.
He does a huge funeral in Washington, D.C. And, you know, one of the things that's really important about this story is you cannot tell this story without, you know, this parallel narrative of the resistors who bring the case and the white man who decided. You cannot tell this story without talking about violence. The violence that had started after the Civil War, the rise of white supremacy, the lynching that starts in the 1880s, continues for another 70 years. Violence is at the root of the relationship between white and black all during this period, and it's really... It's a sad part, a shameful part of the story.
And one of the things that struck me is that its resonance for today, when we try to understand the build the wall mentality and the attempts by the current administration to literally just limit the number of black and brown people who come to the country one way or the other, the systemic racism that we see in so many institutions in America. Given the fact that Plessy allowed segregation to be legal for some 60 years, once it was, you know, repudiated in 1954, it's not like it vanished off the face of the earth, you know, on that day. I mean, the legacy of that decision and the length of time that it allowed this separate but equal doctrine to survive has enormous impact on the climate of race in America to this moment.
Well, just because the Supreme Court says something doesn't mean that people salute. If you think about what happened after the Brown decision, the governors of Arkansas and Alabama stood in schoolhouse doorways and said, no, we're not going to desegregate. It takes a while for the people of the country in all of its forms to accept a Supreme Court ruling. I want to read just the epigraph that I used for the book from Martin Luther King.
Yeah, please. Because
I think it's actually appropriate to your question about the border wall. So this is what King said in 1957. He said it a number of times during a conference in Tennessee. Men hate each other because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they can't communicate with each other. They can't communicate with each other because they are separated from each other.
Yeah, separated indeed. And here we are, you know, dealing with the governor of Virginia, who is a medical student, at least condoned, you know, a picture of a black-faced person and a Ku Klux Klan member. I mean, so this conversation continues. What do you think, we just got a minute to finish up here, what do you think Plessy teaches us about this current moment of race in America?
Well, I think, as for me, I think we need to know this story. I think we need to understand the roots of it and the reverberations of it. As I wrote in an op-ed this morning in the Baltimore Sun, the racial history of this country, racial progress never comes easily or swiftly. And so we need to think about how, even in 1965, when President Johnson, in trying to push for the enactment of the Civil Rights Act, remember there were Civil Rights Act in the 1870s, you know, he said we're going to have an equal starting line. But he knew that there wasn't an equal starting line because you didn't have the wealth and education on the behalf of people of color that whites had had for generations and generations. And you look at statistics today, and we still have that gulf.
Yeah.
So we still have a long way to go.
Different beginnings have different endings. Absolutely.
That's right.
Well, Steve, this is a terrific, terrific read, a really, really beautifully done book. So thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Steve Luxenburg, his new book is called Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. Tonight at 7 o'clock, Steve will be discussing the book with Judge Robert M. Bell, the former chief judge of the Maryland Court of Appeals. It's part of OSI Baltimore's Talking About Race series and the Enoch Pratt Library's Writers Live series. That event is at the Church of the Redeemer in Baltimore, and it's part of, as I say, these two series, and we will have links for it with more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Racism and Redemption. Why do some white and even some black Americans continue to excuse blackface. We'll talk about it and examine it with E.R. Shipp. She's at the Morgan State School of Global Journalism. And Lawrence Ross, he's an author who's written about racism on college campuses. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here. She's going to review Everything is Wonderful. That's the new show at the Everyman Theater here in Baltimore. So it's all coming up tomorrow. On Midday. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street over in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. We've got more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. I'm Tom Hall on behalf of the entire Midday team. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.